money on the table, and the partners are looking at money instead of looking at the expansion plan. And you could be quarreling over how to spend that money, or in fact, steal it from yourselves. Mm-hmm. And then the business goes bonkers. When you have the right governance in place, it's easy for you to know the difference between turnover and profit, and know that what you're entitled to is a share of your profit. The rest of it is not your money.
What does it take to choose the right partners in business?
I don't want to say you should pray for God's grace. Let me tell you, in any business, three critical things.
Austin Awuru is one of the most consequential figures in Nigeria's modern energy story. For over three decades, he has operated at the intersection of capital, policy, and power, helping build the institutions that turn Nigeria's oil and gas sector into a serious global player.
And people ask me, why were you listing the company? And I always like to make this point. We really were not listing the company at the time to raise a lot of money. We're listing the company to save it from ourselves. So we found out that most Nigerian enterprises and Nigerian partnerships, managing success is always the biggest problem.
If you were to go back to your younger self when you started to build this company, Seplex, would you have done it in Nigeria, or would you have done it somewhere else with everything you know? Today, we sit live with Austin Awuru to talk capital, country, and the long arc of legacy. We see the tweets, and every single day what we see is we love Afropolitan. This podcast is underrated. This is the best podcast ever. But the problem is 82% of you are not subscribers, but I know you guys are watching. So I need you to click the subscribe button so you can join the Afropolitan family. Thank you. Austin, so typically in the style of Afropolitan, when we have a guest, right, and you know, our guests, typically when they're watching our podcast, they might be winding down from a long day. They might be going to the gym. They may be even working out. So the first thing I want you to tell our audience, right, is I just want you to walk through, what does it really take to build in Nigeria?
Let me start by saying, and I've said this a number of times, building a successful enterprise should never be complicated. In fact, it should never be a difficult job. If it's difficult and complicated, you are probably not doing the right thing. If you stay focused and your execution is disciplined execution, and you start with your vision anyway, which is to say that you are very clear in your mind what you want to do and what you want to execute. And you are focused, you are disciplined, and then you take it one step at a time. Even you will marvel at the results that will come out of those simple steps. It's never really very complicated. People make it look like building a successful enterprise is some, you know, you dream up some big thing and wake up with some drive that comes from what you can't explain, and suddenly you have built something. No, it's one simple step at a time. Trust me, it's never complicated.
And I want you to take us back, because the first thing I'm curious about is, you know, you started this a while ago, right? And we're now in 2025. If you were to go back to your younger self when you started to build this company, Seplex, would you have done it in Nigeria, or would you have done it somewhere else with everything you know?
Okay, well, my own case is different. I haven't known anywhere else. I haven't known anywhere else. I've traveled around the world, but I haven't known anywhere else. I mean, I finished high school here, went to university, UNN, you know, at the Soka, and graduated at the Soka there and did my youth service in NNPC. And after my youth service, I was retained in NNPC as a geologist and spent 12 years in NNPC. And I was doing so well, I didn't think I was going to leave NNPC. I'd say a year before I left, I had won the GMD award for one of their so-called most resourceful staff. And then somebody came knocking and hired me into the private sector. And that's how my private sector journey started. 10 years working in the private sector. And then I pulled out and co-founded Platform Petroleum. And as I said, if you watch, it's one simple step at a time, really, nothing complicated. Set up Platform Petroleum as a marginal field operator. Again, disciplined, focused. We put the field in production. And everything happened from there. Because with the field in production, there was revenue. Then you could plan. Then you could plan your growth. And 8 years after that, I joined forces with Shiba, another Nigerian company. And we got a technical partner out of France, Morel & Prom. And we co-founded Seplat. Again, we co-founded Seplat, built it, took an asset that we bought from Shell, and grew the production. And so we were able to pay back our acquisition debt and grow the company. And 3 years later, we thought we had a good story, a strong company, a strong brand. And we then moved on to list the company on the London Stock Exchange. That was probably our most ambitious step. And people ask me, why were you listing the company? And I always like to make this point. We really were not listing the company at the time to raise a lot of money. We're listing the company to save it from ourselves. Mm. So we found out that most Nigerian enterprises and Nigerian partnerships, managing success is always the biggest problem. So we needed a platform that will impose a certain minimum governance standard on us. So once we listed the company in London, there were things we couldn't do. There's a minimum standard of governance that we had to work with. And years later, when we had some little internal crisis, it is that governance standard that saved the company. Today, Seplat has grown into... personally, when I look back and people ask me, in 2009, 2010, when you were putting Seplat together, did you think it would be this big? Well, I would say that when we were doing the roadshow to list the company in 2013, and we asked the question, what did we think Platform was going to become? There's really nothing Seplat is today that we didn't say in 2013 it will become. We said it would be a huge gas player. We said gas will account for 30% of our business. That's what it is today. We said we're going to grow the company to a $5 billion company. We're not there yet, but it's a $2.5 billion company. When we started, it was a $400 million company. So again, one simple step at a time, and you just watch the growth, stay disciplined, don't get carried away. It's so difficult to manage success. I'll tell you that.
We had Austin O'Carey on the show.
Right, and he talked about this same thing, about succession planning. And a lot of, there's a field of many dead companies that, you know, founders started off doing well, whether it's traders or entrepreneurs in different fields, and the business died once the main person goes away, right? What was it that you had seen maybe in your own situation or maybe from other companies where you said, you know what, we need to actually start having the foresight to impose these governance models on ourselves? What have you seen in the market?
Again, you've seen, you know, it's governance. All failed businesses that didn't survive two generations, it's a governance problem. So everybody talks about Seplat Petroleum, Seplat Energy now, but there's Platform Petroleum that Platform Petroleum has been in production as a marginal fuel company for 18 years. I was the founding CEO. I ran it for 8 years. And since then, we've had three CEOs after me and who were staff of the company. So again, the succession has been well laid out. We will almost predict who will be the next CEO after the current one, which is why I left Platform in 2010. That's 15 years ago, and it's still running. In fact, there is a tall building in the heart of the business district of Victoria Island called, what's that building called? Greystone Tower. 18-story office building. It's owned by Platform. That's where they are. People don't, everybody talks about Seplat. So that's a marginal field company that has been there since 2002, and is running. Yeah. Succession of CEOs and all kinds of people. Without a governance structure, the enterprise will eventually fold up.
I want to
take our audience back, because, you know, for a lot of us who are younger in the audience, when we hear NMPC, is just filling station that we know. We don't know. We don't typically remember it for what it used to be. So can you walk us through or take us back to 1980 when you joined NMPC? What type of institution was it? What promise did it hold? And when you look back at it now, where are some of the places that, you know, pitfalls that it's fallen into? Because we don't know an NMPC that we would have been proud to say, okay, we want to go and work there, or we want to send our people there. Obviously, people want to go there for different reasons now. But for those of us who are looking to, you know, aspire for something great, what was NMPC like back then?
The story of NMPC, unfortunately, reflects largely the story of our country, which hopefully your generation will have to change, to turn around. I always say to people that whenever you look to the past with nostalgia, there's something wrong. You should look to the past and wonder how. You should say, how did my parents manage? You know, thinking about how good things are now, you wonder how your parents managed. But here we look to the past and say, you know, Marina used to be a beautiful place. Now it's chaotic. And that's the same way all our enterprises are. So if you pick anyone, whether it was Nigeria Airways, whether it's an NMPC, you say, oh, once upon a time, Nigeria Airways had 22 airplanes flying all over the, we don't find Nigeria Airways. The NMPC that I joined as a youth copper in 1980, we aspired to be in such a place. I was a well site geologist, meaning we were drilling wells as an NMPC, making discoveries. We're looking to the future. Now, what NMPC should have been today is what Saudi Aramco is what Petrobras is. Those are our contemporaries. The Norwegian company, Statoil, those were our contemporaries. When the North Sea oil discovery happened in 1972, that's when NMPC was created as an NOC. But while all the others got to where we are, we got to a peak and then a descent, which unfortunately is what you find. Now at the board, 45 years later, we are struggling to see whether we can recreate the NMPC that we dreamt about, at least turn it around into an organization that creates value for the country and for its citizens. It's a tough job, but that's what we're trying to do now.
Yeah, and I want to even go further back, right? Because you lost your father at age 6, right? And your mom instantly became the sole breadwinner. So the first question I have for you during this period of your life is, what did your mother tell you that shaped who you are today? Because so many Nigerians, that could be their story, and that's it. And there's no company, nothing ever gets built. So I'm curious, what did she tell you? How did she affirm you to become the man you are today?
You know, she is, if she stays with us until March, she'll be 93 in March.
Wow.
She's all we knew. There's 6 of us, 5 sisters. And up to today, she means up to today at 92 and even in my position, if she tells me to sit down, I'd sit down immediately. That's how influential she has been in our lives. She sent all of us to school. She shaped all of us, all 6 of us are children. And so we revere her even up to this minute, as old as she is.
But how did you get through that period? Because you were a top student. Like, how were you able to cope?
She didn't put us in a position to know that we're deprived. She simply continued to do what both parents should have done. I didn't lose any class. In fact, it's very interesting because I started my primary one in a small town called Ibetu Ijesha. And let me tell you, that's in Osun State. And I had just finished first term primary one when my father passed and had to return to Delta State. And you know, about a month ago, they have an annual festival called Ibetu Day in Ibetu Ijesha. And I reconnected, I went back to Ibetu Ijesha. I called my elder sister, who's retired headmistress, to come from the village and join me. She was 13 then when we were leaving, so she would have more memory. And we flew to Akure and drove to Ibetu Ijesha just a month ago. My first time in the Petri Dish after 60 years. And I went to identify the primary school that I started at and the modern school that my sister was at. And we're just now in the process of designing and building a block of 6 classrooms for that primary school. So that's where we started. And when we left there, I didn't lose a class. My mom simply ensured that we were all in school and finished high school and went to the university. And yeah, I didn't, she didn't make us realize that we could have been deprived.
Mm.
Yeah.
And I'm even more curious, you know, since you were doing so well in school, were you ever tempted to leave Nigeria? Was there ever a conversation of going abroad, or it was always you were going to remain in the country?
I tell you, the closest I came to leaving the country when I was in high school, what they call class 3. Mm. And we wrote then what they call Eastern Robo Division in Bender State then, an essay competition that I came tops on and represented the division Eastern Robo in what was then the Bender competition and won. And the winners were then supposed to be sent on some one-year kind of exchange program. So that's, I would have gone then back in 1973. Well, fortunately, I would say, because I'm Kwale, and my school was in Urobo, and the Urobos protested that I would be taking an Urobo position if I was the one representing the school that I passed. And so that's how I didn't go. I probably would not have returned if I had gone.
Really?
Yeah, but so I didn't go and I stayed back here. And 3 years after that, I was in university in Nigeria. And yeah, the rest is history.
Where were you supposed to go? What country?
I don't even remember now. I just know that we're going to be sent abroad. You know, I was 15, 14 plus. That was exciting. And I cried when they said I couldn't go because I couldn't be the one representing a tribe that wasn't mine. And that was it. But that was probably the closest I would have come to going abroad. But yeah. And I don't know why I really, really have never. So in 1985 was the first time of going to the U.S. on official assignment. In 1987, I was in San Ramon in California for 7 months on attachment to Chevron. And I remember they brought out forms for me to fill to get my social security number, and they were asking me if I wanted to be. I didn't even want to fill the form. It's now. It's now that I know the value of social security number. And I'm looking for it. I can't find social security number. And I tell you how important it is. See, the tax I pay in my house in Houston. I needed to do, you know, what you call the residence one, so I can get some discount on it, on my tax. Because I don't have social security number, I won't get that. And I remember that that's something that was in front of me just to fill the form in 1987. I thought I didn't need it. So that's why I say, I think I was just destined to be here in this country.
You're locked in.
Yes, I'm locked in. I'm locked in, yes.
Etche, remember that time I walked into a bank, I'm not going to give the name, and I asked them for $1,000, and they told me no, they cannot withdraw any dollar from me. And I was so upset, and I just remember asking everybody, how can I solve this issue? And I'm so happy that I finally have V-Band to finally solve this issue for me.
You know, the thing is, you should be able to have access to your money anywhere in the world when you get paid, right? So I'm grateful we have VBAN as a sponsor for the Afropolitan podcast. With VBAN, you're able to get paid in foreign currencies, whether it's pounds, USD, euros, and you can actually spend it in local currency as well. Now, you're also able to get a virtual card, which you can use to spend in and pay for services across the world, right? So I'm grateful to have VBAN as a sponsor.
You can download it on the Apple or Google Play Store. And remember, when you sign up, you use Afropolitan so they know you came from this podcast.
When you co-founded Seplat in 2009, you were attempting to do something that no indigenous Nigerian company had ever done up until then, which was acquiring IOC assets, right? From places like Shell, etc., right? What gave you and the team the audacity to dream that big, especially because you're just starting from a marginal field? So what was the audacity that came from, we can actually go out there and do this?
To tell you the truth, let me first correct that. Mm. I think earlier than that, Oando had acquired an asset from Egypt. It wasn't quite well publicized, but Oando had done that. And much earlier, it's a small company called Dubri. Dubri had acquired a very small asset, which they produce 500 barrels a day till today from Philips. So those things had happened, you know, they didn't go further than that. But when we set up Platform Petroleum, which was why we chose the name Platform, it was always our ambition that that marginal field that we acquired was going to be our platform for moving into the big league. And so once we put our marginal field on production, and that marginal field is within a Shell asset called OML-38, we actually went out to Shell and said to Shell, we are doing next to nothing in this asset. Can we take it from you and develop it? They didn't listen to us at the time. But when on their own, they had made the decision to divest some of their assets, then they remembered that we had made that application and they called us in. So that transaction was actually a bilateral transaction. We negotiated with Shell and acquired those three blocks and paid and grew from there.
So you achieved a dual listing on the London Stock Exchange and the Nigerian Stock Exchange. How did you go about, because again, for a lot of us, we don't see that many IPOs in our Nigerian context, especially in global listings. What was the process of convincing global investors to invest in Seplat and really explain to the audience, like, what does that feel like? And what sort of, is this scalpel or in, like you just said, they do sort of due diligence that's different from maybe Access Bank doing due diligence. Not to say that Access Bank doesn't do great due diligence, but what does it look like? I don't know why I said throwing Access Bank on that. But what does it look like to convince global investors to invest in Seplat at that stage?
Wait, and I have part two.
Yes.
And because what I also want to know is when we spoke to Austin, right? The other Austin from Computer Warehouse.
Yes.
And he was saying that they almost lost it, right? They almost lost the chance. And I know many Nigerian companies almost get all the way to the end and something happened. So I'm also curious if there was any period of time where it almost didn't pass through.
First, the listing. Well, I don't want to sound religious, but we've always said inside Seplat, that Seplat is a child of God. A few things happen that, you know, so I'll just tell the story briefly. So when we set out to list, and as I said, we took a decision to list the company so that we had a governance structure that we thought could make the company survive. And then we went out, we did the first, what you call a roadshow, to try the market. And what was our story? We have an asset. We've taken production within 2 years from 18,000 to 60,000 barrels a day. We had refinanced our acquisition costs. We had a strong balance sheet. And we said, this is where we're going. We had a 5-year, 10-year story. And we're asking people to invest. Okay? Did that roadshow. And our financial advisors told us it was well received. The next big problem was with the UKLA, the equivalent of SEC here. To even accept that we could list, that's the listing authority. A resource company, oil and gas company like this from Eastern Europe, had listed in London and was a disaster 2 years later. And then we were not just an African company, a Nigerian company. And you know, the British, they wouldn't tell you you can't list. It was always on a Friday that we'll get a result. They will ask, do this, do this, do this, do this. All the due diligence, they ran checks on, even on us as persons, myself and the chairman, ABC or Jacko at the time. But every time, they wouldn't really tell us that. They would just impose more conditions. But one day, I remember this, we called our legal advisors, White and Case, I believe, in the UK, and said to them, go and have a meeting with UKLA when we're not there. Tell them what you honestly think about us. If you are convinced that we're genuine, say so to them when we're not there. If you think we're not genuine, you have doubts about, tell them. So that they'll just simply say, look, we can't list you. You know, 10 days after that, UKLA gave us a clearance to come and list.
Mm.
Wow. It was just that somebody, without us being there, told them honestly that I think we believe these people. And that's how we listed. It was like a miracle. I tell you, and this is on the main board of the London Stock Exchange. This is not a depository listing. No African resource company has done this since then. I can tell you that a number of Nigerian companies have tried since then, haven't been able to. Now, 6 months after we listed, what was the leading Nigerian resource company, which was Afren? Afren crumbled. They had their issues and they crumbled. Now, if the Afren story had happened just a month before us, that's it. That would have been the end of our aspiration. Mm. We had just listed before Afren crumbled. And then they were watching and saying, oh, another. But we have survived. We have survived. As I said, even among our peers on the exchange, we have done very well as a company at Seplat. We're actually a very good story even on the exchange. Yes.
Man, amazing. To put this in context, right? When Seplat listed, they raised $535 million at a $1.9 billion valuation.
Yeah.
Right? So, like you said, almost since then, it's been almost impossible for another Nigerian company to list in the London
Stock
Exchange.
Let me put it in context.
Yeah.
When we were a $1.9 billion company, Tolo was a $22 billion company. Tolo.
Total Energies.
No, Tolo. Tolo. T-U-L-L-O-W.
The French.
Yeah.
Yes.
French, yeah.
Also listed there.
Yeah.
Okay.
Just to tell you how resource oil and gas companies have suffered on the exchange.
Yeah.
Today, Tolo is a $500 million company.
Wow. Wait, they've dropped?
Oh, yeah. So there is no company at the time we listed who had the value we had that its value today is up to what it was when they listed. You know, between then, resource companies suffered, you know, there's oil price and all that and all that. So a number of them dropped. We dropped from $1.9 billion to $680 million market cap until the market built confidence in us. And as we kept improving in performance, we are now at $2.5 billion and rising. Yes.
Yeah. Now, for a lot of people in the audience, they might not understand the intricacies that go into oil and gas production, right? So when you say things like 22,000 barrels to 100,000 barrels, they're like, just increase the number now. What's the issue?
Yeah.
But can you explain to the audience the work and it actually takes to scale from 22,000 barrels a day to 100,000 plus barrels a day, especially because it was a 5X scale, right? And the importance of that is that what are the operational challenges involved in scaling products at that level?
It will be the same thing. It doesn't matter the business you're doing. Even if you were running an oil palm business, it's about how many tons of oil palm are you producing a year? And if you are scaling it from X tons to Y tons, what do you need to do? How do you expand your business? It's the same principle. Doesn't matter what. Even if you are running a chain of restaurants, it's the same thing. Whether you're increasing from 5 outlets to 20 outlets. And that's where running a business gets tricky. Your business can remain small and can fund your lifestyle. It is when you try to scale that it gets complicated, because then you borrow money to scale up. Then you expand even your workforce. Then you bring in more people and so on and so on. It starts getting a little bit complicated. And that's where everything I've been talking about, discipline and focus, comes in. Again, managing success. When there's money on the table and the partners are looking at money instead of looking at the expansion plan, and you could be quarreling over how to spend that money, or in fact, steal it from yourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And then the business goes bonkers. There are partners in businesses here in this country that are richer than the company itself. So all of us are struggling to see how much we can get out of the activities of the company.
Yeah.
And then we're individually very rich and the company is going down. That's quite it. So when I say that managing success is not easy, those are the things I'm referring to. When you have the right governance in place, it's easy for you to know the difference between turnover and profit and know that what you're entitled to is a share of your profit. The rest of it is not your money. Once you get to that mindset, then you can grow your business. You now know what it is to plan for the expansion, what it takes. And even when you borrow, once you go to sleep, knowing that I must repay my debt. It's the first step. If you're going to sleep, believing that if I don't pay, even if we go to court, I'll be fighting the banks in court for the next 5 years and I will repay. That business is on its way down.
What does it take to choose the right partners in business? I think one of my favorite quotes is play long-term games with long-term people. Like you said, you still have to come up with a governance model. Like the team or the management staff has to agree on this governance model. What advice do you have for first-time founders who want to build a business about how to choose the right partners in business?
I don't want to say you should pray for God's grace. But let me tell you, in any business, three critical things. The prospects of that business itself. So if we're in the oil and gas business, if you're looking for an asset, say, what's the prospectivity? What kind of reserves do you have there? How easily and how quickly can you put it on production? How much revenue do you expect from there? That's the prospectivity of the business. How good do you think the business will be? You tick that box. The next one is, no matter how good the business is, how quickly can my products get to the market so there's revenue? So that even if I'm owing, you tick that box. The next box, who is the counterparty? Who am I doing business with? If that box is X, even if you're picking gold along the street, walk away. Mm. If the partners cannot work together, they destroy the business. Doesn't matter how good the business looks. And it's a very tricky thing. There's no rule about it. You pick your partner in your best judgment. And then you go on. But if you find out that the partnership cannot work, find a way to simply exit it, because otherwise all your efforts will be in vain. It's so critical that partners or shareholders in a business are aligned on where they're going and how to get there. Otherwise, you'll be wasting your time. Mm. Yeah.
Thank you. And, you know, one thing I also want to talk about is, because when people in this country talk about they want to get into oil and gas, they always feel like it's only for government. It's only for people who know certain people. If someone was to start that business today, number one, is there a specific area they should go to? And the reason why I'm asking is I just went to Imo State. There was the Imo State Economic Summit. And the governor talked about gas and saying we overproduce so much gas. There's that opportunity. But is there other opportunities? Help demystify this part of starting an oil and gas business.
Okay. Now, let me say this. What we have done in getting into the oil and gas business from platform to Seplat is a story of what the future of this economy will look like and what it portends for you younger ones. If you go back and if you read my book, My Entrepreneurship Journey, I think I made a point of that before going into the real story, that this economy has expanded slowly because the expansion has always depended on what part of the economy has government withdrawn from. Okay? You see that every part of the economy that government has withdrawn from, there are entrepreneurs that have moved in and made a success of it. Whether you're starting with even the media, we don't remember that once upon a time it was only Radio Nigeria, NTA, and Daily Times. Nigerian entrepreneurs moved into the media and seized that. In 1989, 1990, the banking thing came in. And today we have Nigerian banks that fund us in the oil and gas industry, hundreds of millions of dollars. Okay? That's banking. Now we're seeing manufacturing. It was only NNPC that had refineries. Now we're talking in the next 3 years, we might be a refining hub for all of sub-Saharan Africa as a country. It's the same thing in the upstream. It looked as if it was impossible. For 60 years, only six multinationals were running the business. And what were they doing? Simply extracting raw material, that is crude oil and natural gas, for their own energy security back in their countries. Now, as government opened it up, we have now seen that Nigerian companies have stepped in, and it's no miracle. We're doing it. Your dad was just telling me he was passing by what used to be ExxonMobil signboard and now see Seplat there. It would have looked impossible. So I'm saying to you that, and that's most of sub-Saharan Africa is now realizing that indigenous entrepreneurs have to step into the economy and take the bull by the horn, because nobody's going to do it for you. Nobody's going to do it for any of these countries. For 65 years, we didn't have any refining capacity. Okay? It's none of the multinationals that would have come here to build refineries for you, because once the currency of the business is local currency, they're not going to invest. They will not. Not in the oil and gas industry. So the story of what you're seeing now, whether it was Renaissance, whether it was Seplat, whether it was First EMP, is the beginning of what happened 30 years ago in the banking sector. And once it spreads across, even little things like oil palm, just see what is happening now with Nigerian entrepreneurs taking over what used to be state-owned oil palm plantations and building on it. So from Okomo and Presco, you are going to see about 5 or 6 of such things in this. And then from being an importer of palm oil, we're going to become a net exporter in the next 10 years. Every segment of this economy is now open to young people like you to go in and choose where you want to operate. And let me tell you, an enterprise is not successful unless it's solving a problem. Whatever you choose to do that provides a solution to a particular problem and you are disciplined will ultimately be successful.
And so I also want to switch into your family office, right? And this is very interesting to me because I feel like there's not a lot of Nigerian families that literally open up a family office. They're operating, they're investing in things. I'm curious, what made you open it, right? And did you get any advisors or anyone to tell you how to even structure it so that it outlives you?
Okay. First, when we're doing our roadshow for listing Seplat, I remember that in Washington, one young man came in. So the roadshow is your financial advisors will list those you make presentations to.
Yeah.
And he came in and he was looking to invest, you know. And we asked him, he said he runs a $1.5 billion family office. We said, what's family office? Okay. So a family office, so that we don't confuse a family office from family business.
Yes. let's get it right. Yes. Yeah. Family office.
Family office is the same thing as a PE firm, a private equity firm. But a private equity firm will take money from investors who trust you to invest the money and make returns to them. A family office is the same thing, but it doesn't take money. You are using your own funds for your investments. Okay? A family business is any other business. It's run by the family. So a family office is an investment vehicle. But you are using your own funds. So when I was planning to retire from Seplat, I then decided two things. I remember speaking with my friends and I said, I won't write a will. I don't like will. Because long after you have died, and even your own son or whoever feels that he hasn't benefited well from the will, we swear to an affidavit and actually go to court to depose to an affidavit that you were insane when you were writing the will. Just because he wants more.
Yeah.
So I said, no. So whatever I own, I will aggregate all of it into a trust that is a business. And those who would have benefited from my will then are beneficiaries of that trust. Mm. So you all, there's nothing to fight over. You don't even have to work in the business. If you want to be a pianist, go and be a pianist. And if you're a beneficiary, whatever is available to be distributed, you get your share of it.
Your dividend.
Your dividend. Everybody knows what it is. So I set it up. So before I retire from Seplat, we then set up the company, hired a chief investment officer who is still there with us, and transferred everything I own personally into this trust and family office. And we had Zedra. Zedra used to be the private banking arm of Barclays. So they are the administrators. So set it up properly. And so when I retired from Seplat, I then came in as the executive chairman. All I get there is a salary. I'm paid for working there like any other person there. Every revenue from my investment comes into the family office. We run it like any other company, annual reports, audited, and so on. And now we drew a line around where would we invest. So we're in oil and gas, which we understand, upstream, up to gas processing. So we don't do consulting. We don't do contracting. We're not even in the downstream. So we're in the upstream, which means I can invest in a producing company or a producing asset. We're in real estate. We're to try to get into real estate both here and in the US. We're in agriculture, and even agriculture is focused on greenhouse. We produce just pepper and tomato and an oil palm. That's it. And then we are in listed equities. So we have a balanced portfolio, bonds and so on. So it's well defined. So we know how much revenue do we have from our current investments? How much do we, and then we run a philanthropy that is quite robust. We spend a lot of money on that, a Jesuit secondary school that is running. So we get our revenue. What is the overhead? How much are we putting into philanthropy? And what is left? And then we decide how to apportion those investments. So that's how we run it. And we've run it now for 5 years. The structure is very clear. So I think that even if I wasn't there, it would be clear to everybody, you know, one comes in. Starting from this year, we started what we call distributions. So that once we start doing it, if I stay long enough, it will become such a tradition that even if I wasn't there, the beneficiaries will know what the distributions look like. It's nothing to fight over. Mm-hmm. So I'm happy about it. It's very well structured, very well run. The family office. Yeah.
I'm sorry. This is actually, I've never heard of a Nigerian family office detailed like that. So please, we have to take note of that because this is, it's really an accomplishment.
Yeah.
You're one of the few people who might be able to relate and understand how hard it is to accomplish what Dangote did with the oil refinery, right? Can you explain to the audience why that refinery might benefit or be beneficial to Nigeria, especially on the global stage? Some of the challenges that are involved in the global stage of setting up a refinery like that and being able to either export, refine, and just the whole process. What does that look like?
You know, I was speaking to somebody else and I said, part of what stands in our way, both as entrepreneurs, as an economy, is too many things that we think are impossible. Which is why I started by saying, in building an enterprise, if it's complicated, you're not doing the right thing. It's always quite simple. So you take Dangote. So for 60 years, we haven't had refineries. State-owned, not well-run. For the past 30 years, these refineries are practically not produced. And then we built a downstream business that is based on the fact that there will never be refineries in Nigeria. So there were depots, there were all manners of things. Everything was based on import petroleum products and distribute. And with the advent of subsidies and so on, the sole importer was NNPC. So there was a bigger business about being an NNPC importer, importing on behalf of NNPC and calculating subsidies and so on. And everybody got carried away with how much money there was to make. And then Dangote shows up and builds a refinery. He was able to do so because he had a business that had a balance sheet that enabled him to. It's so important to understand this. If you just went to the bank and said, I want to build a refinery, you couldn't borrow the money. The reason was the only competitor you had was an NNPC regulated segment of the industry. So you couldn't borrow. But because he had a cement business that was a multi-billion dollar business, he could borrow against that to build a refinery. And everyone in the downstream was still carrying on as if without paying attention. If the people who are going through all these chemistries today had asked themselves 5 years ago, supposing a refinery is built, how will it affect my business? None did. They're all building depots and importing. Then he opened the refinery and they still thought it was impossible. Now they're scratching their head and finding out, I'm not going to buy any products from him. I will still keep importing. Now that is going to stop. It doesn't matter whether it's by legislation or anything. All that fight is on. It will soon be over. And all marketers will come to terms with the fact that your business is a volume business, simply selling your petrol stations. There are people who made so much money in the downstream who have no petrol stations, just importing. All that is going to change. So that's a major game change. It's exactly what I'm saying to you, that in almost every segment, one or two people will get into the segment, demonstrate that it is possible. The same way early investors demonstrated that banks, we can have banks other than Standard Bank and Barclays Bank in this country. It's going to be the same story in every segment. Dangote has just demonstrated it. Dangote is now, you can see what it's trying to do across Africa. Because when you get to a point where you have a $30 billion a year turnover, you can fight and you can do big things. That's where he is now. We have to come to, and I mark you, almost every country we have such big entrepreneurs. You know, in India, whether it's the Tatars, yes. If you go to Morocco, if you go to Egypt, the Sawaris and so on. When you have two or three of such big entrepreneurs and on some banks, then that economy is in the process of being totally transferred to the private sector. That's where we're headed. And that's where you should be planning to play. Yes.
Let's talk about energy transition. You know, in the West, they always talk about decarbonized, obviously ESG. I know you've expressed that countries like Nigeria should maximize their oil and gas, yes, you know, capabilities, right? Can you explain to our audience your thesis on that and why that's important? Because a lot of us are diaspora-based folks, and we hear these news about decarbonized carbon credits, this and that. What is your thesis and framework around this?
So African countries, particularly sub-Saharan Africa, have come up with what they call just energy transition, a just transition. A transition, everybody agrees, I'll put it this way, 8 billion human beings on Earth need a clean environment to live well so that when we go, our children will find a place to live. But the same 8 billion people need a certain minimum quantum of energy to also be alive. And so whether we wish it or we don't, the energy that the world needs has to be provided. Today, the bulk of it comes from fossil fuel. Even if there was no problem about, you know, the carbon footprint and all the environmental problems, fossil fuel is finite. At some point, it will finish anyway. And therefore, technology was always going to provide an alternative to fossil fuels. Otherwise, human beings will not survive, maybe in another 50 years, okay? Remember that coal, when coal accounted for 82% of world energy, when coal gave way to oil and gas, it didn't require any fighting. It was a natural, it's about, you know, it was a natural transition. So this transition we're talking about was always going to happen because there must be energy. Now, so, but what really are we speaking about? So you look at sub-Saharan African countries, we still have that resource, oil and gas. In some cases, accounting for 60-70% of our total revenue, especially foreign exchange. You cannot say to me today, abandon these resources you still have in the ground and join us in the march towards renewables. What we're saying is, we will first invest and maximize that resource. The revenues from that resource is what we're going to use to fund the transition towards renewables. But even in the process of maximizing that resource, we will decarbonize. So, for instance, Seplat will tell you that there are no flares now in any of their fields. That's what every company that is doing, that is being responsible, should be doing. And where you were using diesel generators, you are probably now using gas or renewables. So, first of all, we have to minimize the carbon footprint of our operations without leaving the resources in the ground and come up with a reasonable and responsible program that says, if in the next 30 years we have no oil and we have no gas, where would we be? If you take countries like Saudi Arabia and UAE, they started that journey 20 years ago. They saw the future and have been investing the resources from the oil and gas in non-fossil fuel and building an economy completely away from oil and gas. The same thing with Norway. Norway has built a $3 trillion sovereign wealth fund out of all their oil and gas, just from 1972 to date, the same year that NNOC was founded. So we need to then run our economy in such a way that the remaining resources, we monetize the resources and run our economy responsibly so that at the date when the oil and gas is no longer there, we would have built an economy that is sustainable for all of us. So that's what African countries are calling a just transition. We will join in that transition journey, but we'll do so without leaving our resources in the ground. That's what that transition, that's what the African countries are saying.
And you were instrumental to building out the blueprint of the Nigerian Content Act of 2010.
Yes.
So I'm curious, did you feel like you achieved anything? And fun fact, I actually interned at ExxonMobil here. And so I remember when I saw the ExxonMobil sign, so to now see Sepla is very interesting to see that transition. So I'm curious, what did that do for the local content scene in Nigeria?
It's first of all, it's a major accomplishment. Yes. It has its own drawbacks in terms of cost of doing business and so on. But what that has, and by the way, so the way I participated was NNPC then, I wasn't NNPC, but they set up a committee to look at enhancing Nigerian participation in the oil and gas. And I chaired that committee back then and produced that blueprint that then became the NCDMB today. But I'll tell you, the capacity of even just Nigerian contractors, the capacity that they have today, and then the capacity that we're now building in the upstream as operators, you won't find it anywhere else in Africa. I say to people, this is not the only environment where multinationals have divested. In most other countries where multinationals divest, independents from Europe and America come to take their place. But here, multinationals are divesting and Nigerian companies are taking the place. Here, you are seeing Nigerian service providers actually moving in and doing work. I remember going for African CEO Forum, this is when I was still running Seplat, and we're sitting at dinner with somebody from Zambia, a pharmacist from Zambia. The Zambian president was there at the dinner. And he was asking me, I don't know how you Nigerians do it. I'm a pharmacist, but I can't even set up a pharmacy shop in Zambia. All the pharmacy shops are run by Indians. Mm. It's when you go to other countries and find out how the indigenous are simply not part of the economy. That's when you appreciate how far we have come as indigenous entrepreneurs in the economy.
Yeah, that's true. And I want to ask you a more personal question. So with everything you've achieved, all the wealth that you have built, is there still a
all
part
you
of... No, you're disciplined. I know you're very disciplined. You're not just cash everywhere. But you have a family office. But I'm curious, is there a part of your life that you thought it would be something different? Is there still something that you're mourning? You thought maybe you thought you would have a different life, or you thought you were going to have a different way of being?
I would say no. And the reason is, like I said, it is no part of my life that I would say it was some big creation, something. It was just taking one step at a time. Like I said, I finished from university, then I was an NNPC. Then I finished youth service, then they hired me. Then I worked there after 12 years. Then there was an opportunity to go to the private sector, and I did so. At every point in time, I tried to simply make the best of whatever situation I found myself. It's the same one step at a time. I ended up with Seplat and then building it. And then here I am. I'm now trying to make a success of running a family office so that it's a well-run enterprise, whether I'm there or not. And so because my steps have always been, again, I don't want to sound religious and say it's the way God has measured my steps. So I can't think of anything that I would say, oh, I wish I did this differently. But the one thing that I take very, very seriously is my philanthropy. Mm. We spend in AA Foundation, we have an annual budget of $1 million to spend on AA Foundation, on philanthropy. And if we are lucky to get, if we become more successful, that figure could go up. But that's more, I'll give you an example. When we're going to open the Jesuit Secondary School in 2023, and the Reverend Fathers, Catholic priests who run it, came to me and said, look, we're 6 months away from this being, if you think you can't get it ready, say so that we'll postpone it. And I said to them, if I have to sell my house for us to be ready in September, I will do so. That's so the philanthropy is more important to me than personal accomplishments, you know. If I'm building a hostel in that school and I'm building my house, I'll probably slow down the building of my house until that hostel is finished. So I think maybe as you get older, those things mean more to you now than just trying to make money. Yeah. Mm. But that's where we are.
For the ambitious Africans in the diaspora as well who are looking to move back, you know, there's a lot of challenges with building in Nigeria. What advice would you have for them from a mindset shift perspective in order to build institutions that even outlast them if they're to move back as well?
So let me tell you about diaspora, diaspora and Africans. They are out there enjoying the best of that world, waiting for the right time to come and strike here.
Yes.
Yes. It's always been like that. It's diasporans, when they moved into Liberia, they ran Liberia forever. The same thing with Sierra Leone. That's the thing with diasporans. Let me tell you, India, that's why when people say Japan and all that, there's nothing wrong with it. India had people all over the world. All over the world. You go to Harvard today, maybe a third of their human capital are Indians. When they got things right in their country, it is so, those same Indians that returned with all their experience and knowledge and exposure to help to build India, that in 30 years, India has gone from being a sorry state to now becoming the third largest economy. And I see that it may not be in our time, but once we manage to get the running of this economy right, all of you will troop in here and provide solutions to what have been problems and grow this economy and benefit from it. That's what I see. That's what diasporans are eventually going to do when they get here. Yes.
Do you feel like they should just come back, or do you feel like they should wait for something?
You know, each of you will find an opportunity. Mm. There's no real date for it. Whatever you're doing, you will find an opportunity, you jump in. And there are a few of them who've come back and set up businesses and are not returning. Instead of pulling people back to come and join them. It's going to continue. But we, the political space has to get more discipline and run this economy properly and provide the opportunity for those who have solutions to come back and set up businesses, providing solutions to our problems.
We created the Afropolitan podcast because we wanted to make sure we tell the stories of those who came before us and those who are coming in front of us.
Our stories deserve to be documented and remembered.
And over here at Afropolitan, our drink of choice is Inveroche, which is a gin from South Africa, because we believe African brands are global. So Eche, what are you toasting to?
To our builders, our innovators, to show that Black brilliance exists worldwide.
I am toasting to African creativity. I feel like the world is just blossoming with beautiful African storytellers.
Here's the legacy.
And stories worth sharing.
So babes, I'm always talking to you about investing. How's your journey going so far?
It started because you've been on my head for the past 6 months about investing, and you'll be proud of me because I actually found an app I love. It's called RiseVest. And actually what I love about it is that you can start with $10 and it automates everything for you. So literally I just go to the app and literally it's investing for me every single day.
Yeah, because we know you're not going to be a trader anytime soon. But with RiseVest, you're going to be able to invest in US stocks, right? Fixed income, real estate, etc., right? And so I'm happy you're finally on board.
And you know, the funny thing too is I always tell my girls that as women, we're not investing enough, we're not talking about it, and we're not having these conversations. So I shared it in all my group chats. So you can find RiseVest on the Apple and Google Play Store.
Okay, make sure to use code Afropolitan so that they know that we sent you. You know how every week we sit down with people who've done it, people who've built, people who've led movements, people who've created culture. What if you could do more than just listen to them? That is why we built Convo by Afropolitan. On Convo, you're able to book one-on-one video calls with in-demand experts from Africa and the diaspora. Go to convo.vip to get access to your next mentor, because sometimes one convo can change your entire path.
So Austin, we're going to move to our rapid fire. So anything, like the first thing that comes to mind, I want you to say. So I'm going to do a softball, something easy, and then we'll go. So first question I have is, what is your favorite Nigerian food?
Vegetable and anything to swallow with vegetable soup. Whether it's amala or pardon, yeah, or whatever, it's vegetable soup.
Every Nigerian answers, what's vegetable soup? Some soup, the pounded yam, something.
Yes.
Okay, what is your favorite city in the world?
You know, I could say Cape Town.
Mm-hmm.
I could actually say Cape Town. I would say Cape Town.
Okay. What do you like about Cape Town?
It's a beautiful city.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter where you are, whether you are somewhere in the mountains looking down.
Yeah, the cliffs.
It's a beautiful city. I could easily have said Monaco. But these days, I can tell you, we're getting to a point where we might be saying Kigali. Rwanda, yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
I was in Kigali in 2019. And when I went back in June this year, I couldn't believe what I saw. But let me also tell you, Abuja is a beautiful city.
Yeah.
In fact, I was drooling about Kigali. You know, I went there with my wife and she said, well, you can make all the noise about Kigali. I don't think it's better than Abuja. Then the last time I went to Abuja and actually drove around, it's a lot more beautiful city than we think it is. It's actually a beautiful city, Abuja. Mm. Yes.
Mm-hmm. What's the biggest mistake you made building Seplats?
A couple of people I hired I should never have hired. Should never have hired. Yeah. And let me tell you,
yes,
when you're interviewing to hire people, be very careful. Be very careful, especially when they're hiring to real top job making positions. The most eloquent people that we talk you smoothly through what they have done and where they were, especially those who have gone from one company to the other, be careful. Be careful.
Okay. Yeah. Best business advice you've ever received?
It would probably be the one that came into my office and said, do you know this Seplat? You could list the company.
Mm.
And let me do some preliminary work and tell you what the value would be if you listed the company. And he came back and said, you know, this company can be valued at between $500 million and $1 billion if you listed it. I said, okay. And because my partner and chairman was, his background was running a family business where he was everything. So I thought he was going to be the biggest obstacle to listing the company, that he wouldn't like to lose control. So they made the same presentation to him and he was gonko. So both of us bought the idea. You know, the man who, as a banker, brought the idea to both of us is the current CEO of Seplat.
Mm. Wow.
Because we eventually brought him in as the CFO when I was CEO. And he succeeded me as CEO. Still
Wow. Yeah. And the final word is, what does the diaspora need to understand about building in Nigeria? I just want you to give one word.
It's possible.
Mm.
It's possible.
I want to sit with that.
Yeah.
It's possible.
Yeah. Bear that in mind. It's possible.
Mm. Okay.
We're too quick to think it's not possible. That's what stops us.
Mm.
It's possible.
And the last question we ask every single guest on the Afropolitan podcast is, who do you want to see in that couch? This is a different couch than the one we have. It's normally at our home. And whose story do you want to hear?
I have a lot of respect for Alhaji Dangote. Yeah.
Okay.
Anybody who can create the level of value, let me tell you, two people. And some of the people that I respect so much are people that ordinary people will quarrel with. So you look at Alhaji Dangote and what he's done in Nigeria. Do you know who else you should ask yourself what he's done? The Chaguris.
Mm.
It's just, I came straight here from a court where John Momo and Fred are having, and you go to the rooftop and you look out. And you see, first of all, what he created out of Eco Hotel. I knew Eco Hotel run down when he bought it for next to nothing. And what he has created out of it. And then you look across to the Atlantic. What was a problem? The Atlantic eroding our shores. And he created a city out of that body of water that we're seeing today as Eco Atlantic. Look, when you have visionaries that think nothing is impossible, That's what an economy needs. That's what those people are there. Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you so much, Mr. Austin.
He's normally that stuff like that.
No, I have to sit with that for a minute, though. But thank you so much. It's an honor and it's a pleasure. And thank you for blessing us with your wisdom, your experience. And like I said to the audience when we first started, the reason we started this podcast is to honor people and give them their flowers while they're still alive. So thank you for stopping.
Thank you. Thank you. It's such a small world. I stepped in here today to find out that the two fathers of both of them are my friends. Yeah. I only found out the same thing. Yes.
Thank you
very much for having me.
Thank you.